Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight, I'm not even sure how to describe what we're going to be talking about tonight. I have Jeff Ritzman with me and Ren Collier, and it kind of starts off talking about the role of belief in paranormal things, not just UFO phenomena, which we, of course, deal with a lot, especially with Jeff, but just paranormal stuff in general. Like, what is the role of belief, and is it a gateway to let these things into our reality in one way or another? We also talk about different research methods and things like this. This is actually a two-part interview. Patreons will get both parts together, actually. But it's really hard to define exactly what the confines of this conversation are. So I hope you enjoy it. It's a little weird in some spots, because we are talking about some different theories and different ideas that are out there and that have been acquired from different sources. Well, you'll see what I mean. All right. I am working on a member section for the website. So if you don't want to use Patreon, you will get the same stuff through that member section. It's not quite set up yet. But again, I have to thank John Shooter for helping me out, and check out his online radio station, Deprogrammed Radio, which has all kinds of great shows on it. So, thanks to him. If you want to become a patron in the meantime, it's $3 a month, and it helps out fantastically. It really does. I am trying to up the number of shows you get every week, and there's some other stuff we're working on, and every little bit helps toward that goal. So I thank everyone who has donated anything so far. You're all awesome, and I hope you like this conversation. So here we go. All right, welcome, Ren. Welcome, Jeff.
Hello there.
Hey, everyone.
And this is the first time you two have actually talked.
It is.
Indeed.
You guys got into quite an interesting conversation in our Slack group, and I figured I kind of want to move it to a show, because you were talking about some really interesting stuff. And I think the first thing I want to talk about here is the idea of belief in these paranormal sort of phenomena as a gateway for these things to exist in our world. And there's a few different ways to interpret that.
I'm going to let Ren go first.
Yeah, I was going to let Ren go first too.
Yeah. So I have recently been reading a couple books. I had a trip and had a chance to finish some. And I specifically read The Crypto Terrestrials finally. And, I read Nick Redfern's Final Events, and a lot of things in it resonated with me, because it sounded like things that I had heard before, like specifically when I was reading The Supernatural by Kripal and Strieber. Mm-hmm. The idea that belief in these topics is dangerous, or at least a group of people involved in the quote-unquote cover-up believe that belief in these topics is dangerous, and that whatever these non-human entities are, feed on belief, or even can enter our world in greater numbers because of belief. And Final Events kind of goes into this idea that they're trying to do this because they feed on us, or rather this group, the Collins Elite, believes that they feed on us, specifically feed on our souls. And that was really interesting to me, because that's not the first time I've heard that before. You know, I've heard that in a lot of places. Specifically, Strieber at one point mentions that he believes that the visitors have to do with the human soul, and they specifically say to him that they recycle souls.
Yeah. Isn't there something in The Key too about that?
I haven't read The Key yet, but I think you're right.
I think there is something in The Key about us being like cattle for someone.
Yeah.
And that's part of why we can't leave the planet.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's something that, again, I've seen in a lot of different sources. Specifically, the two big things that kind of set off alarms in my head were the works of Robert Monroe, who wrote several books on out-of-body experiences. Specifically, he wrote a trilogy of books, starting with Journeys Out of the Body. And in the second book, Far Journeys, he has this experience, this sort of like revelation that is given to him by sort of this non-human entity that is his like out-of-body traveling partner, almost sort of like a guardian angel type figure, but not quite, more like a kind of a guide. Mm-hmm. And he discusses the fact that Earth, or at least organic life on Earth, was manufactured and put here on as a sort of engine to produce a certain kind of energy that these, you know, non-physical like life forms feed on. He called it Loosh, which is a really silly name, and I hate saying it, but that's what he called it. And that it's interesting because there's a disconnect. It's not the soul. That's the important part. The Loosh is this energy that is produced by fear and suffering, specifically suffering that at the moment of death. So animals generate Loosh, you know, when they predate other animals. Vegetables produce Loosh when they're eaten by, you know, animals. And people produce, apparently people are sort of the prime Loosh producers, because they produce more fear and suffering than any other animal on the planet.
Sure.
And this energy, this energy is then fed into these enormous beings that Monroe observes that act as sort of, I don't know, it's like they're beaming energy all over the universe. It's this interesting idea that maybe organic life is actually a rare thing. Like maybe organic life doesn't actually evolve naturally. It has to be seeded, and it's like a panspermia kind of idea, and that the Earth itself is like a greenhouse or a garden. And they specifically refer to it as a garden in Far Journeys. And there's a really interesting part where this revelation is weighing on Monroe, and he realizes why this has to be kept secret from people, because he thinks, like, he says, like, quote, what would happen if the Guernsey cow discovered that her milk had value? What could she herself do with it if she didn't have a calf to feed it to? Could she save her milk? Could she spend it on more hay or protein vitamin blocks? What if she then discovered man was taking the milk she produced? Rebel? Refuse to deliver any more milk? And it's like this idea that this secrecy has to be kept in place in order for this system to continue. And the other work it appeared in that I recognized was James Merrill's The Changing Light at Sandover, which if people aren't familiar with it, is a 600-page epic poem that was basically channeled by Merrill and his partner through the medium of the Ouija board. Hmm. And he talks to various entities that give him revelations about UFOs and sort of the history of Earth and the solar system. I made some quotes, a little notes here, but like one was, out of it came man. The story of that climb into oxygen is known. The selection of God B's vehicle, 88P/C, composed of chemical formulas operated by electrical energy, known. We are the custodians of that electrical non-angelic 12 stored in the batteries of man's heart and mind. So sort of the same idea, like man, like organic life operated by electrical energy and composed of like molecular bonds was created by these entities as like a battery source. Let's see, there's another note. Like, we have said before that souls precious to us, like Einstein, outlive their usefulness. So another duality, mind as usefulness, decays to mind as non-usefulness, and we now seek license from God B to reveal something of heaven to those souls we need back. So like sort of the idea that they need the souls. There's even a point in Mirabelle Book 1 where they lament the fact that people aren't dying enough. They say, daily, we need 5 million souls and have not half that number. Quality fails. Even with plagues and wars to diffuse population explosion, even with those suicides, we more and more applaud. Oh yes, they are a great boon to us when of returning lab souls whose interest work is done. We have in the past half century had to resort to souls of domestic animals. Most recently, the rat. By 2050, these two will be exhausted. And then? And something that ties into the contactee movement is the fact that they're incredibly concerned about nuclear weapons. Because as they put it, my little green notes here, in great mass deaths, a soul of rare value has been known to slip through our fingers. We suffer keener losses among atomic researchers exposed to gamma rays, an odd deterioration making for nearly total loss of these highly cloned talents. And they refer to atomic energy as an acid that literally eats away at the soul. And James Merrill responds to him. He says, those scientists exposed to gamma rays, you seriously mean their densities can ever be recycled? Yes, these accountable losses are somewhere in a gain, but where? I doubt we are in charge of soul densities, and these losses, like those at Hiroshima, leave no trace in atmospheres known to us. So they have this idea that they're not concerned about atomic weapons destroying the Earth. It's like it cuts into their profits, you know, like apparently destroy souls. And that's an idea that I've heard William Burroughs say, that atomic weapons destroy the soul.
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that's also mentioned in the key.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, it fascinates me because it's like, where is this meta narrative coming from? Like, you know, regardless of whether or not it's true or whether or not there's any objective truth to these, essentially channeled information, it's interesting that various sources who have, as far as I know, no interaction with each other at all, separated by gulfs of time, basically all see similar things. Like, to bring up Monroe again, there's a point where, let me go back to Far Journeys. There's a part where during an out-of-body experience, he comes across this mass. So he feels sort of this sexual energy, and he sees this enormous pile of writhing forms. So he gets closer to it, and he realizes that it's people. It's like dead people. Like, it's like their spirits. Like, there's just an incredible mass of them just writhing and laying there like zombie-like with each other. And it's people who's in death, like, instead of their spirits or their souls like recycling or reincarnating, they're stuck on Earth in this sort of sexual pile, like constantly just driven by their basis instincts. And he tries to pull someone out of it, and they just immediately like jump back in. And that's very similar to something someone sees during a near-death experience in Final Events. In Final Events, someone basically sees the same thing, like this huge mass of just completely seeming comatose human bodies or spirits that UFOs are like shining lights on and are sort of sucking up energy into. And there you have the idea of them being harvesters again, like sort of harvesting things.
Now, remind me, I don't think I've read Final Events yet. Which book is Final Events? That's the one on Roswell, right?
Well, Final Events is Nick Redfern's book on sort of the... It's largely about the Collins elite, the sort of group of people who had originally started investigating the occult activities of Jack Parsons and Aleister Crowley. And are you familiar with like the whole Jack Parsons Babylon working thing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So these were people who were basically afraid that in 1944, Jack Parsons, by doing the Babylon working, actually opened the gates to another world. And that's where the UFO flap and the UFO phenomenon was coming from. I don't quite agree with that because I
think
they've been seen since before 1944.
Yeah, exactly.
But these people sort of come to the same conclusions, though, that the UFO entities are basically tricking or deceiving people into believing that they're from space as a way to hide what they're really doing. And that's harvesting human energies or human souls upon death to feed like whatever you know, they need, like they're using it as an energy source. And it's sort of like a chronicle of Nick Redfern's sort of investigations with them and like documents he receives and has meetings with. And it's got this whole very spiritual warfare thing going through it, because like there's also this narrative thread that like specifically they want people to like not believe in Christianity, but other religions are fine, which is very strange. I don't know how I feel about that, but it's something that I feel is maybe making a comeback now with the whole secret machines thing, time to launch thing. But yeah, this meta narrative has been present since like the specific being fed upon human as cattle narrative has been here for at least since like the 1940s or possibly a little bit earlier than that. And that's kind of what I'm interested in exploring, like where does that narrative come from? Because I have some like sociological ideas about where it comes from, but I don't know. I'll hold off for a minute so we can talk about some other things related to this.
Okay. Jeff, what are your thoughts?
That's a lot to unpack, isn't it?
No,
not at all. Well, I think the first bit of belief opening floodgates and such kind of goes back to what, I mean, if anybody listened to Paratopia back in the day, that I used to say a lot was this notion of the more you give, the more you get. That was kind of my mantra on the show for years, because I noticed, at least in my own life and that of people that I was in close contact with, that there seemed to be a pattern of the more attention that you paid to this phenomenon, the more you read, the more you consumed of it. If you actively went out and looked for phenomena of one kind or other, whether it be ghost phenomena, it doesn't matter what the phenomena is, you would tend to see a ramping up over a course of days. And when I say days, I mean within a week. So you're putting yourself out there pursuing this thing, whatever your chosen phenomena might be. You're going out, say, nightly to look for UFOs in a rural place, on a rural hill somewhere. And I think that you have to look at what that entails. That entails you breaking routine of getting home, eating dinner, maybe reading a book or watching TV and going to bed. Sometimes you're out really late because you might see something, you might not see something, but you're still going out night after night. You're breaking that routine that you're normally in just in daily life. And at times this can lead into an obsessive behavior, which leads into being late for work, possibly losing your job. You know, all of these things tend to follow suit. And I think that that kind of rolls into the notion of that there is a toxic effect to dealing with the paranormal. And I should say that when you do, I mean, there's a lot more to it that I don't know if I should really get that into, but should you want to experience phenomena, I've always said all you need do is go look. But it requires a certain amount of devotion, a certain level of preoccupation in your life with it that it's going to demand from you. And you're going to get breadcrumbs, I think is a good way to put it, in the beginning, in the first couple of days, 3 or 4 days. You're going to get these tantalizing bits of something in the sky that you can't quite identify, but doesn't really say UFO, quote unquote. I'm not sure what it is. Looks like it might be Earth lights. Looks like it could be very distant planes with scintillation effect on them. And then as you go forward from that, as that entices you into more devotion and more absorption into the phenomena and the information and all the literature, and every kind of paraphernalia that can come with it, these things will leave you little doubt at certain points. And then at that point, you're in it. This kind of thing really bothers me to talk about, but it's one of those things where you're out there, and it's a gradual build up, but there's a certain point where it seems to skip a couple steps, if that makes any sense, mm-hmm. and presents you with something that you weren't prepared for and that you didn't expect. And that could be in the ghost phenomena, that could be in, again, pick a phenomena. You will get something that will be pretty in your face and pretty undeniable. You may be with people. You may be without people. You could be alone or with a group. Excuse me. It doesn't tend to matter after a while. I think at that point you realize that, I remember, my own big event was me sitting at home, kind of staring at the floor going, it's all real. It's really real. It's not something that again, we come on these programs and we talk about this stuff, and it's all fine to throw around conjectures and theories and all of these things. But bottom line is, if it's standing in front of you in the floor, it's a completely different scenario. And that's one that I half the time I say, I wish people could see it. And the other half says, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. Mm-hmm. But at that point, that can turn a life upside down. And I think depending on where you're coming from with it, what your pretense of belief in it is, and possibly even your own psychological issues, which we all have of one kind or another.
Sure.
Can play out in these things. And that becomes a whole nother scenario where, I always look back on the Dorothy Izott case where her experiences started out very benign and very pleasant to her. She described men coming in a light to her room and saying, we're going to teach you things. We're going to show you things about your world, about this and that and the other. It was very informative. It was very benign. It was almost Space Brother-like. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now I'm not sure that I buy into that narrative either, but everything was great with her, and she was getting these very unusual photographs that people blow off way too easily, but she's getting mountains of photographs that are very compelling. She's having these amazing experiences until one day she tells her pastor about these experiences. And his words to her were, well, I hope you realize that what you're dealing with is of the devil. And that made her doubt her own experiences. She says, could I have been being deceived? Could I be being fooled by these things? And she said, at that point, I began to come into the house and see things scurry into corners, and the whole thing became quite frightening. And it took me a long time to establish my innocence with it again, to get it back to where it was. That to me tells us a lot. That is a massive clue. And I've heard this not only from Dorothy, but from a lot of people, that it depends on what you bring into the table. It's almost, and I hate to say it this way, because I don't mean to try and push everyone to thinking that this is all akin to the psychological, but it's almost akin to what Terrence McKenna describes in A Mushroom Experience. somebody would say, this is not anything like what I expect. And the mushroom would say, well, what did you expect? And they just say, well, I kind of thought it would be a little scary. And the mushroom leans in and says, oh, I could be scary. You like scary? And that's, I hate to say it, but that's almost really similar to the theme of contact with an other. There's this point where if you can keep yourself together, this could probably be peak human experience, but you are just boiling under the surface of, can I hold it together and not run and not scream and not freak out? Because that is often the first course of action to take. But there is that component to it. And so when you witness that narrative, that to me is a feedback loop. It's exactly what I say. It's if you bring love and light to the experience, that's what it seems to reflect back at you. This thing holds a mirror up to a lot of people. And Whitley has talked about this among thousands of other people, have said it seems to reflect back at you your core perception or your core outlook, which is even interesting when it comes to ghost phenomena. This thing seems to repeat into that as well. But it seems to be feedback loopish, if that's a word. There is this pinging that you have to ping out, and then it returns the ping, and eventually that reaches some kind of fever pitch and something erupts. And by that time, into my line of theorem here, you're in a completely anti-structural, you know, state of behavior. You're probably in liminal states because your life is deconstructing. That can be misinterpreted, because I've certainly misinterpreted in my life that this is evil or demonic or it's going to consume you. There is a consuming going on here. But I think that's just kind of the nature of where this phenomena tends to come from. I don't necessarily think that the phenomena itself is evil, but certainly there's a toxicity to routine, to normal life, to relationships. And in some people's cases, as we talked about, Sarai, on the last couple of programs, groups and the mind, the state of well-being. And I think that's where a lot of these things erupt of demons and soul harvesters and all that. Because there is a connection to the dead, I'll say it that way. You know, Whitley is certainly not, by a long stretch, the only person who's ever reported seeing the dead with quote-unquote aliens.
Right.
So all of these things point to, again, something much more complex, much, much deeper than an extraterrestrial thing. This does point to some kind of something steeped in liminality and anti-structure, but at the same time, something reflective. And something that you bring up, Jeff Kripal, you know, the paranormal is a story waking up to its author. These things are narratives, they're story, you know? And I think when you look at the people who relate these things, you find these very creative minded people. And that's not to say they're making it up, but they're certainly in that marginal field where these kind of things are blown off or dismissed out of hand. But there is narrative being created. So whatever they're approaching this with, or however they're seeing this thing, it is inherently fearful at times. I think everybody can acknowledge that. And so if fear is what's coming back to us, then I'm sure that the narrative can run into what is the most horrible thing I can think of? The me no longer existing. You know, that's part of where that's part of my fear. But that's where my fear comes of this stuff, because I don't like being out of control. Right. And I know that this thing, when it presents itself in my life, I am out of control. I have no control over what's going to happen. I mean, it's that unpredictable. And so, you know, I choose to be very routine in my life, and I choose to live a normal life rather than drowned in this stuff. I do agree that that there probably is some kind of the seeming desire of the phenomena to be acknowledged as real. I think says a lot. In the way that it's a team, I guess you could call it a team effort, into how these things happen. So you can on one hand, you've got the anti-structure and you've got the liminal states and all of those things that follow into life behind that. But there's also, you know, I'm not going to say that this phenomena doesn't troll every now and then for people. I think it does. I think it does troll. It throws a line out, and whoever bites, how many get hooked? So that would not surprise me. But again, this is all theorizing. We honestly don't know.
One of the quotes we brought up a number of times in the UFO history shows were the one where the one contact, it was contactee or whoever, the person who was having the experiences was told, we want you to believe in us, but not too much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, like, this is the thing that Keel warns about in the Mothman Prophecies. He talks a lot about how, especially UFO researchers, you're chasing these phantoms and these monsters, they get sort of trapped in belief systems and biases. And then, like you said, it creates a feedback loop where they find exactly what they're looking for. And that's the danger. You know, they never find anything they weren't looking for.
Right. And they acknowledge that. So, you know, the confirmation of that, I mean, we've all talked at one time or another, what about so-and-so? They sound like they're off their rocker, don't they? And I used to be one of those people that would go to the nines to disprove someone's account as this is not how this works. But in fact, you know, it is how it works, because this is the reason for a lot of the infighting and the discord in these fields and the differences of opinion, is because people who approach us from one direction or another, I think everyone loses sight of just how tailored the experience is for each individual person. And so I hate to use the word that's your truth or that's my truth, but I think that really does bear out what it is. Same phenomena. For one person, it's a demon. For the other person, it's an angel. And there's everybody in between.
Yeah.
Everybody's perceiving it, honestly. I don't know that anybody... I think there are delusional people. Don't get me wrong. I totally get that. And there are people who are just desperate to belong somewhere and people who make stuff up. Yes. But there are people who... they wouldn't make this up. They wouldn't make a fool of themselves to make up a story that doesn't make any sense and seems absurd to everybody. Mm-hmm. And they are opposing. They're diametrically opposed to each other. And those people will fight over, well, they raped me. Yeah, well, they taught me about whatever. Mm-hmm. I never had any of that. I don't think that's real. And then you get the conflict. Do you blame that on the phenomena? I don't know that we can. I don't know that that's something that we can go, well, that's its fault.
Well, on the other hand, I sort of said something provocative on Twitter last night, where I made the statement that it's probably not a coincidence that the bourgeoisie never see UFOs. And just to clear up, by bourgeoisie, I mean the strict Marxist sense of, like, people who own the means of production and capital, not like, you know, intellectuals or artists or whatever, or like rich people. I mean, like the 1% type of person.
Or at least that we know of.
Yeah. And I think, so have either of you read Jung's book on flying saucers?
Mm-hmm. A long time ago.
So yeah, in that he sort of describes that, or puts forth a theory that these phenomena, these manifestations are like a psychic manifestation of society's angst or anxiety. And if we want to put aside the idea that all of the soul harvesting type stuff is literally true, like if we want to look at it as maybe a metaphor for certain things, I have this idea that the reason this narrative is so prominent in the early 20th century is that it is a manifestation of basically the proletariat's like angst about sort of the dehumanization and crushing cycle of capitalism. Because it's interesting, like the capitalist system dehumanizes people. It's a way for you to extract labor from people and turn them into machines, basically. And the fact that the UFO phenomena appears you know, the whole narrative of us being kidnapped and taken, our control is removed, we're forced into the system where we are treated like animals. Like, I see, like, as a socialist, I see a metaphor there. Like, maybe that is a manifestation or metaphor for people's anxieties about the system that we live in, that we're forced to participate in, that for many people crushes them. And, you know, you look at the huge UFO flaps that happened during the fall of the Soviet Union. You look at the flaps that were happening, you know, in 1944 and the sort of the shadow of like nuclear test and the first rumblings of the Cold War and sort of this shift from the old world that existed prior to World War II into the new one. It's like a transitional state. And that's when these things manifest. Like, I think it's no coincidence that there have been a rash of Mothman sightings in Chicago just a couple weeks ago. Because, like, this country, even right now, is undergoing extremely turbulent, like, violent shifts that I believe we're only seeing the first, you know, inklings of. And, you know, what if, like you mentioned, Jeff, we bring something to the table? What if the phenomena reflects that, and it's reflecting our anxieties and it's reflecting our worries? I mean, is it any coincidence that people were given visions of nuclear disaster, nuclear, like, Holocaust, like, while nuclear tests were going on, or while we were in the Cold War, or that in the early 90s, when climate change type information started coming out, that Whitley Strieber was shown images of ecological disaster? Mm-hmm. You know, like, these fears are, like, reflected in the phenomena.
Right.
Well, look at Ouellette's work too, where he compares, he basically calls UFOs a social poltergeist.
Exactly. Literally the zeitgeist. Literally, like, that's exactly what that word means in a, like, a literal sense. A ghost of culture. Like, it's a phantom reflection of society's anxieties and fears and ills. I mean, that's the very metaphorical way of interpreting it versus, right, you know, right, the nuts and bolts sort of, you know, demons eating our souls kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the whole thing is hopelessly steeped in symbology and in metaphor. I mean, and I think I've talked about this on other podcasts about how symbolic all these things are. But I think you know, just like we were talking about the database thing on our little chat program there. Mm-hmm. The problem that I have with these kind of, like, collective reflections manifested into some kind of weird facade that presents and brings us either this illusion of possible rescue, which is the other side of the coin from being shown disasters, that there is this notion of you're going to be shown this and you're not going to have to worry about this. You're protected. You're safe. This is a common theme that you find in experiencers. The problem I always have with going off of these, and you're right, don't get me wrong, you're right about the transitional aspects of the world and time and changes that are going on. My outlook on Chicago would be, watch Chicago. If I lived in Chicago, I'd be leaving Chicago. you know, because these reports are getting more and more frequent. And I think we know, at least at this point, that a lot of these things are harbingers. So they're precursors to events. But that's only one of their roles. And so when you look at these broad examinations, like through time and seeing the transitional state, I'm totally down with that. Where I kind of take pause with something like that is the notion of the reported phenomena all being correct. I guess is the best way to put it. These things are extraordinarily murky, and that's why they've always kind of existed in these very marginal interests. They haven't been taken up by mainstream science. They haven't been acknowledged by major works of science, even. And so when we say that there's, you know, the doom and gloom scenarios from Aliens, that's certainly been a theme. There's been other themes that have come up pretty much in the same time period. So you're going off that. Again, there's all sorts of people reporting these things. Yes, there is there seems to be similarities in some of their stories, but I step back from that and I go, how much of this is cultural contamination? How much of this is, how many people are just simply making up a story? I know that I encountered a lot of people back in the 80s, early 90s, that were clearly following a narrative that they had seen on TV.
Yeah.
Right. And I guess the thing that I don't know how many people know it nowadays, because I really don't interact with, like, you guys are the only people I really interact with anymore in the paranormal. I don't know how much people know these days, but a lot of the narrative that you've heard about alien abduction or even ghost sightings, these are all very homogenized via someone's ideology, whether it be Hopkins and Jacobs' ideology in the alien experience thing to ghost hunters and ghost adventures and whoever else when it comes to ghost phenomena. Those are the two big ones to me. Those will always be my big areas of interest, are those two things. I mean, you find some inherently weird stuff that doesn't seem to fit any pattern at all. And a lot of what you see on TV and a lot of what you hear repeated on internet chat forums and whatnot, this is coming from researchers, and I'm making those air quotes with my fingers, that not always are these things passed through a decent filter to know what are we looking at. That's why I try to stay with what surrounds, what are the tenets of surrounding phenomena. I think from there you might be able to work inward, but I'm also, like, I've always, whenever I bring up the psychological aspects to George Hansen, he always says to me, psychology is not equipped to deal with the paranormal. It's simply not equipped. And I used to not understand what that meant. But I'm slowly starting to get the idea that it's almost like the materialist reduction of psychology. It's always going to relate to some chemical imbalance or some kind of trauma in childhood that relates. And those things are certainly present in some, people who report abductions or have preoccupation with poltergeist or any of these things.
Well, it's what Kenneth Ring called the encounter-prone personality.
Exactly. And I don't know that his notion of a personality actually even fits correctly. There are certain hallmarks that people have. I think I mentioned on our chat app, there was something that I used to ask years ago, which was, what's your ancestral heritage? If you've ever taken an IQ test, what did you do? How did you do? Was it administered by a psychological professional? Have you ever had any affinity or involvement in the occult or what society might deem to be a cult? Another one I used to ask was in addition to, have you ever partaken of a psychedelic drug of any kind? Another one I used to ask was, have you had any experiences that you might consider to be child abusive or molestation? I got a lot less hits on being molested as a child.
Yeah, most people aren't going to just want to say that.
A lot of people were really open about that with me. So a lot of people said, yeah, I was. But I found just as many people who said, no. And these weren't just average people out of the, these were largely people that I had met and talked to and over time built relationships with.
Maybe it could just be any sort of trauma though,
It can be, but you would be shocked at the notion that I could write down an envelope. I mean, 10 years ago, this was like a party trick for me. When I'd go to a MUFON meeting and I'd see, or I'd meet experiencers or people be introduced to me, I'd say, okay, so I got this envelope here. It's sealed. You can see it's sealed. I'd hold out in front of me and I'd say, what's your ancestral heritage? They tell me your IQ thing. Some of them didn't know. Some of them would know and would tell me. Mm-hmm. Someone would say the psychedelic drug. And I'd open this thing up and it'd say Celtic, Irish, German, above average IQ, not necessarily genius, just above average.
Right.
Usually I'd say about, it's just a guess because I threw away a lot of my files from back then, probably 75 to 80% of the people that I talked to had some experience with a psychedelic drug. And some people, not always a voluntary type thing, like somebody put acid in my drink at a party, that sort of thing. never
pleasant. Sure. Likely story. Yeah,
right. And involvement with the occult almost always.
Yeah.
Almost always.
Wow. You so, love me, Jeff. I've got like every one of those ticked off. So
sure. Yeah. And again, so did, oh my God, this is terrible, sir. I help me out here. We did a show together, me and this gentleman right. from Pennsylvania.
Oh, Timothy right. Render. Yeah.
Tim. I mean, so the same with him. I've now added to that list. Are you a creative personality? Almost always, yes, of one kind or another, writer, artist, musician, can be any combination of that. I'm not talking about somebody who does latch hook. Okay. We're talking about people who are inherently creative personality. So it's kind of like, I don't know. I can see where people would say the interpretive part of this relies on a creative person to interpret it or to parse it. And the people who aren't creative, this is the other part that's pretty interesting. People who aren't necessarily creative, which was a small portion of the people I ever talked to, after their experience, were massively creative.
Right. And you see that with near-death experiences just as well.
And you see that with psychedelics.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's probably not a coincidence that Strieber studied Gurdjieff, and right. guess who also did? Bob Monroe. So, you know, it's, yeah, I mean, there are these factors that definitely play a part in this. And it's something that I discussed with Soraya on another show too, but that if they weren't like that before, they're sure as hell going to be after they have the experience. And that there's something about the experience that seems to change people. Like it rewrites them. Almost like how certain parasites rewrite, you know, their host in order to further propagate themselves. So there comes the idea of belief again.
Right.
Perhaps these experiences change people in such a way that they then are more encounter prone and also more prone to spread their beliefs to others, thereby infecting them with the same memes.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you where my stumbling block is with this, and I probably have mentioned this before, I'm guessing. Yeah, I have, because Sarai asked me if I could take a picture of it. There's a crystal that's been in my backyard for years. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I were out on Saturday or Sunday afternoon. And I said, I wonder if that crystal's still over there in the garden. And I went over and I picked it up, put it on my forehead like a moron. She held it in her hand. The thing almost felt like it was vibrating. And I brought it in the house. I said, well, we could use some good vibes, what have you. Went to bed. It was a Sunday night. I went to bed. As I closed my eyes, it looked like there was a light on my forehead pointing down into my eyes, but not from the outside, like from the inside. Like I saw white, not red, like you would see through your eyelids. And I opened my eyes and I blinked a couple of times and I shut them again. It was kind of gone. It was a little bit still there. And then it gradually just went away. So I sleep like the dead. I don't wake up. My wife wakes up to, you know, walk the house aimlessly or, you know, go to the bathroom. I don't wake up. I woke up in the middle of the night. I have no idea what time it was. I know it was very late. I know that there was very little light in the room. But something woke me out of a dead sleep to the point where I was as awake as I am right now. And I open my eyes, and I'm already looking at a spot about 5 feet off the ground, directly in front of me, at the corner of the desk that I'm sitting at right now. And there was a very thin-built, large-headed, I mean large head, like basketball, maybe a little bit bigger, round head, standing beside the bed. Didn't say anything, didn't get any vibe from it, didn't anything. In fact, couldn't really figure out what I was seeing because the room was dark. The only light that was coming in was from outside. The neighbor has a floodlight that's on all night, and that light was shining in the room. That's the only way I could really distinguish anything. I could see clearly the light on the side of its face. The more I looked, I could see features. I could see eyes. I could see mouth, temples. And it seemed to be incredibly haggard, wrinkled looking, which wasn't really the typical for things that I've seen. And it was just staring. And to get a better look, I leaned up on my elbow and kind of leaned towards it to go, am I, what I actually thought I was looking at was like the fan that we have for the table with maybe some clothes thrown on top. I'm like, that must be the fan. But I'm thinking that's another foot taller than the fan would be. I could not, for the life of me, figure out what I was seeing. But yet something inside of me is going, you know what you're seeing, moron. You know what this is. You know what this is. And yet there was no outward fear from me. I saw the face, but it was hard to distinguish. But I could, the longer I looked, the more I could make out. And I don't know how else to say it other than I eventually just kind of gave up and flopped back down in bed and I went to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how does somebody go to sleep during that? Okay.
Happens all the time.
Well, yeah, it does. But that's, you know, well, I wake up the next morning. I don't say anything to my wife about it. I don't make the connection that I put this crystal to my forehead because I don't believe in this crap. Okay. I don't believe in crystal magic crap. I don't. And so I get up, I go to work. I'm thinking about this. I'm like, how can you not have freaked out? How can you not? Because I can picture it in my head, even still today. I can picture this clearly. I was completely awake. I knew I was awake. I knew I wasn't dreaming. I knew this wasn't lucid dreaming or anything like that. Because when I leaned up on my elbow, it actually leaned away from me. And I said to myself at the moment, did that thing just move? Did that just move? What is this? What am I seeing? This is going on in my head as I'm, anyway, the next day I go to work. I'm thinking about it constantly. I'm like, you gotta, because you're gonna open up another door here and this is not gonna be good. Because this was viscerally there. So my friend comes over for dinner on a Tuesday night after the Sunday. And he knows that we've seen some very strange things in the house. And I think at some time during conversation, my wife was sitting on me, sitting beside me on the couch. My friend was over in the chair across from me. And he says, so anything weird going in the house lately? Have you seen anything? And I said, no. I said, with the exception of Sunday night, where I don't even want to talk about what I saw because I don't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm afraid it'll freak her out. And she says, I already know. I said, what are you? She goes, tall, thin guy standing beside the bed with a huge head. And I did not want to be here. I did not want to be here. For the next week, I didn't go to sleep until 6 o'clock in the morning. And I held down a 9-to-5 job, by the way, because I was literally so freaked out that this thing was getting ready to erupt into a 3-ring circus again. But everyone that I spoke to, including mediums and people who claim to have had some interesting psychic experiences, have said, yeah, that crystal you put in your forehead, don't do that. Don't do that.
And where did the crystal come from?
I don't even remember. It came from, I know when we bought the house, it came with us from the condominium. In the condominium, it was out on the porch in a flower pot. Now, the medium that I spoke to, she says, well, you don't ever want to do that with something like that, because that crystal's been out there at the time it was 4 or 5 years. It's now, we've been in the house 8 years now, so it's been out 8 years. She goes, that's what's called an overcharged crystal. And meanwhile, I'm thinking, like, I'm doing the, you know, masturbatory hand signal here. I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever. No, I don't know what the deal is with that, but I know that something utterly bizarre happened that was confirmed independently by my wife without me saying a word. When I told Dr. Coke John about this the next day on the phone, he said, this is brilliant. This is independent confirmation. This is wonderful. I said, wonderful for you. Not so much for me.
I just keep thinking of that scene from Poltergeist where he's like, you move the headstones, but you didn't move the bodies.
Right.
They moved the headstones, but they left the crystals.
Right. So I took the crystal promptly out of my front window and put it back where it belongs in the garden. And never will I touch it again. My friend Joe Gooch over in the UK wants me to send it to him. And I'm like, Joe, I don't know how I can touch this thing.
I'll touch it, Jeff. I'll come get it for you.
Well, that's what I keep telling him.
You come on. I mean, I'm not kidding. I have said this to anybody. If you want to stay here overnight, you're more than welcome to. I have a spare bedroom. You can grab that thing, put it on your forehead. You can go in the bedroom and go to sleep. And tell me what happens. I mean, just tell me.
Well, Jeff, you know, Shaver Mystery super fans would know that it's actually a stone book. And, you know, that was it was the way that the taros who lived underground, like, stored information. So, you know.
Yeah. this is the part, you know, when you mention, like, I think people in this field could look at that experience and go, okay, I was good until he said crystal. Now I'm out.
What's interesting about it is the fact that it... So here's my hypothetical. If you had been terrified, what do you think would have happened then? Rather than you having the reaction of, oh, that's weird, and going back to sleep. Do you think that it would have played out differently had you been scared?
I've thought about what if I had said something.
Mm-hmm.
What if I'd have said, hello?
Yeah.
I mean, what would I have done at that point if it had said, yeah, hello?
Yeah. Hey, how you doing?
I've sort of had this working
What are you glowing
theory.
For, dude? Like, what's that all about? You know, I mean, I don't know how that could have played out any different than it did.
So I've got this kind of working theory of so, you know, I constantly shift from looking at this thing metaphorically and looking at it literally. But looking at it literally, I've had experiences similar to that in that, you know, I think I talked on an earlier show about one of my earliest sleep paralysis experiences. This little jangly skinny thing walked into my room and stood next to my bed. And
I read that on your blog. Yeah.
Yeah. I was terrified. You know, it leaned in almost as if it were feeding. And, you know, I've constantly told people, this is something Lon Milo Duquette talks about in Low Magic, talks about the sort of entities you encounter in that in between state, that are quite literally just vultures. You know, they're just hanging around waiting for someone to get scared. And then they kind of swoop in and just try to drink up whatever emotional energy they can out of that experience.
Yeah.
I think about when I was a kid, I had this distinct memory of a nightmare that I had. And as I get older, the more I think about this nightmare, the more I wonder what it really was. But at the time, I was pretty young. I was still in a bunk bed with my little brother. He's a couple years younger than me. And I remember having this nightmare that I wake up and I hear that he's crying. And I look down over the side of the bunk bed because I was on the top bunk. And there's, you know, a little gray standing there. And it's like, staring at him, and he's really scared and he's crying and it's really upsetting him. And before then, I had been sort of terrified of the image of the gray and stuff, you know, from shows like Sightings and that sort of thing. I was constantly afraid of this sort of experience. But seeing my little brother like crying just filled me with this sort of just like rage. And I leapt off the top bunk onto this thing and just grabbed hold of its eye and just like ripped out its eyeball. and it just starts screaming. And it's almost like its eye peeled off like it was a visor or something. And underneath, there were all these red and green lights. Almost like the inside of it was like a window to the stars or something. And then I don't remember anything after that. And, you know, I don't know what I think about this experience. I honestly think it was just a dream, you know. It's too weird. But the only thing about it that makes me doubt that experience is that just, like, recently, a couple months ago, I learned about Daryl Sims, and I thought it would be hilarious to go, like, look up stuff about Daryl Sims. So I was looking over one of his, some webpage. I think it was, like, the Fade to Black page before it went offline. And I saw this drawing of like a gray with one of its eyes removed, and underneath were all these, like, it was red and white lights. And I read what the image was about, and it was apparently during some, you know, hypnotic regression. They suggested the hypnotized experiencer fight back, and she did the same thing I did. She pulled one of its eyes off and saw the same thing I did, and that's the only thing that makes me doubt that experience. Like, was that really just a dream? Because that sort of confirmation across two different sources makes me feel extremely uncomfortable.
Yeah, it would, yeah. Well, I'll tell you my only hands-on thing, and it's short, because for years I would kind of ignore or negate anything that happened in bed at night. Like, I never needed hypnosis for anything to remember anything. And if I didn't remember anything, that was just fine. A lot of stuff happened the daytime. A lot of things happened in waking hours. If it happened after I went to bed, I was always suspicious of it. But I did have one that was, it was kind of a tandem, again, weird thing. And this was, both of these were at the condominium that we lived at. It was a second floor condominium. I was laying in bed one night. I literally just dropped off to sleep. And at the time, I had a little boy who liked to get out of bed, come in and, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy." Yes. I mean, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I woke up one night with something scraping my forearm that was near the door. So I was on the left side of the bed. From my perspective, my arm would have been towards the door, outside the rest of the bed. Mm-hmm. And something scraping it. And I wake up, and I'm like, if I wake up and that boy's standing there, I'm going to tan his backside. He's going to get put back in bed. It's like 1:30, 2:00 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I open my eyes, and here is this thing standing beside the bed. And it's got a silver needle, like about the size of a knitting needle, I guess, thing. And it's scraping my arm. And like you, I had had so much nonsense at that point in time that not only was I really tired, but I had become really irate about the whole thing. And I got pissed off, and I said, "What the F are you doing?" And it says, "My job." And I said, "What do you mean your job?" He said, "I'm a volunteer." And he said, "You're a volunteer too." And then that's all I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know, maybe, I couldn't tell you how many months went by, but it was a matter of months. And at this point in time, we had switched the bed around. Now the bed was on the wall facing the door rather than being the one on the door. So we're on the complete other side of the room. And I wake up one night, and not dissimilar from the one that was much taller than these things, it's just standing there. It's just standing there. And I got really angry. And for some reason, I had the overwhelming sense that it was keeping an eye on me because it was doing something with my little son. Mm-hmm. I had that overwhelming, like, nothing was said. I didn't see anything. I didn't hear anything. I just had that overwhelming feeling, like, it's like the lookout for what's going on in the other room. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Probably just father feelings of that sort. And I reached up and I grabbed this thing and I literally put my thumbs in its the middle of its head and I squeezed. Mm-hmm. And when I did, it fell apart like so many layers of pastry dough.
Mm-hmm.
It crumpled like I couldn't eat baklava after that. Because it's what it looked like, and when I squeezed it, it became very dry, and it just like so many layers of wet petrified toilet paper, and it just like literally fell apart in my hands, and then I don't remember anything, and I wake up in the morning and there's nothing there, there's no crumbs on the floor, nothing, but again, very viscerally real. But I always those said, well, you were in bed. So I never kind of put those in the same category as, you know, Lisa and I beside the road watching something very close. That was never in the same realm. But like, well, you, I always go, you know what? I could swear that actually happened. I could swear that was what I saw. I did have other experiences where there was something in my son's room. You know, so that stuff did happen, but can I absolutely lean back on that experience and go, yes, that absolutely happened? Mm-hmm. I can't, because I was in bed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you want any sort of confirmation, at least for any of that, I think I wrote about on my blog, to the last sort of dramatic out-of-body experience I had, I found myself, you know, surrounded by these large sort of shadowy dogs that I felt were, you know, trying to intimidate me or scare me away. And, you know, I may be sort of new to the UFO thing. I may be kind of new to summoning demons and that sort of thing, but I'm not new to out-of-body experiences. I've been doing this for years. So I just thought it was funny. And I just like waved my hand at them and just was sort of like, you know, be gone basically. And they just faded away, just blew away like dust in the wind. Because I think some of these things, that's all they are. They're just vultures. They're just like, I mean, or, I think they even like old in magical terms, they're considered larvae. You know, they're just leeches that just feed on fear.
Let's stop right there.
Okay.
And let's come back and finish this in the next show.
Okay.
So there's a good another hour to that conversation, and it probably could have gone on much, much longer. I'm going to have these two back together. They seem to kind of click really well on some of this stuff. And, yeah, it was a really interesting conversation. I'm going to have both parts up for patrons. Everyone else, it'll be up in a week. You can become a patron at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Everything's at wheredidtheroadgo.com. And I also have some other stuff I'm going to be putting up for patrons, hopefully very soon. It's stuff I've meant to get up already, but I haven't had time to do the editing on it. And, of course, the archives and everything else of the main shows will always be free. You'll always be able to find them on the website, right back to the very first show. And, yeah, I guess that's it. We're going to play you something from a friend of mine named Steve Blackheart. I believe the band was called The Will. It's a few years old. It's probably close to 10 years old. This is a song about legends, about what happens after we die. See you next time.
Thank you.